Morning, everyone. Senate Capital Investment Committee will come to order. And this morning we have about an hour and a half, and so we'd like to cover several topics, one of them being the Department of Natural Resources asset preservation, flood mitigation, and dam safety. And then transportation, we'd like to have a presentation on the road and bridge, the local road and bridge program. And then Senator Dibble is going to come down and go over the proposals that went through his committee, the bonding proposals. And then we'll have a presentation from the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and a presentation on the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which is CREP. So I'd like to invite Mr. Kent Lacasmo up, and thank you for coming this morning, talking to us about the Department of Natural Resources and some of their programs. Morning, Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kent Lacasmo. I'm the Director of Capital Investment for DNR.
Who are you with?
And last week, MMB presented the governor's capital budget request for DNR. And the handout, the first handout that you have is our total capital budget request. And I know you want to focus on the first several items on there. MMB showed for asset preservation, they showed $23 million for improvements to DNR facilities. That number contains both $20 million specifically for asset preservation and $3 million for facility development. Those two appropriations work together because you can't spend asset preservation on every type of building improvement that you may need to do. The asset preservation is a significant need for DNR, and it has been a high priority for Commissioner Landwehr in this administration. And Commissioner Landwehr specifically is, very concerned about improving the working conditions for our staff. And for DNR, our asset preservation definition is contained in Minnesota Statutes 84.946, which is natural resources asset preservation. It's a much broader definition for asset preservation than just buildings. It includes all of our recreational type of infrastructure. So it's not only the 2,700 buildings, but it's the water and sewer systems with that, 2,300 miles of forest roads, 650 trail bridges, 590 miles of paved trails, 1,500 water accesses, 1,019 water control structures, marinas, the Sudan elevator shaft at the Sudan Mine Park. So it's a significant amount of infrastructure that the DNR needs to maintain. In 2014, we just completed a condition assessment of all of our facilities, the buildings. This was a uniform process that was developed by admin, and we did this work through a contract vendor. So we looked at all of the buildings, and the results of that were that we have 215 buildings that are in very poor condition and 540 buildings in poor conditions. To address the deficiencies in those buildings, it was estimated to cost $55 million. So it's a significant need across our system. And this year's asset preservation.
What was the second? The first was very poor condition.
And the second category was poor, 540 of poor condition buildings. And then it goes to average and good to excellent. So it's a five-number scale, with one poor being the worst.
Okay. Thank you.
This year's asset preservation request of $20 million would be used to address building deficiencies across the system. It's about $7 million. That would include work at Itasca State Park, specifically looking at the Nicollet Court area of buildings. The accessibility for the Americans with Disabilities Act to assess or address those those necessary fixes. We always have code violations and health and safety issues that are our top priority for asset preservation. There's sewer and water issues, heating, ventilation issues, roads and bridges. So it's all types of activities that we would be addressing with this appropriation. And including trail rehabilitation, there's probably be about $4.5 million for trails, and that's to redo the Cicada Trail from Lake Madison to Waterville, which, as I understand, that trail is in such poor condition that people now avoid the trail and go out and ride in the high shoulder of the highway. So it's certainly not a condition that we want to leave unfixed. And we'd also then replace three bridges on the Munger Trail, two of which are currently closed to vehicles. You know, they're okay for bicycles, but not for vehicles. So we have about 590 miles of paved trails in the state, and 100 miles are currently in the condition that warrants rehabilitation. That rehabilitation generally costs about $100,000 a mile. So our unmet asset preservation needs across the system end up being in excess of $35 million a year. So it's in the past, we haven't had the funding in asset preservation to really attack the conditions of all of our recreational facilities. So these dollars will go a long ways to addressing the most critical needs.
If you had, I think the plan is that some of these buildings are in such poor shape that they'll actually be demolished and maybe replaced by a different building I know in visiting with you some time ago, you mentioned that there are plans for some buildings to just, you know, be demolished. If you had the dollar figure that would maintain the assets of the state, what would it take?
Mr. Chairman, for... the unmet needs for all of the buildings, if you just looked at the buildings, up front, based on the condition assessment that we did system-wide, to bring all of those buildings into, or to address all of the deficiencies in all of those buildings, the cost... was $131 million. And not all of those buildings are, have critical issues on all. Basically, the facility assessment looked at all of the areas in a building, from the roof to the envelope, the windows, the heating systems. They looked at 20 different factors. Some buildings may have very poor heating and ventilation, and that needs to be addressed, but the whole building doesn't need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And there are other buildings, as you say, if they're in such poor condition that it would be more economical to replace the building, we would approach that. And that's currently what we're doing at the office building in Glenwood, which will be funded partially out of asset preservation, previous appropriation, and partially out of the new building facility development dollars.
Okay, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be a question more for you, Mr. Chair, or someone else, but I was just thinking that how, there's always requests for HEPR dollars for Minsky or the University of Minnesota. Is there any similar pot for state or similar structured fund for state buildings? I mean, now we're just talking about DNR, but it would seem to me that there's probably always needs across state facilities. Are those always, do agencies always come with individual requests, or is there ever been like a fund similar to
Mr. statewide?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, the Department of Administration does get some funds, and we have accessed those on occasion. I think we did for the Sudan underground mine repair after the fire there, although they do not have very much appropriated to them either, because I think the need is obviously in the hundreds of millions of dollars, mm-hmm. and their numbers are quite limited also. So I think you do see individual agencies coming and asking for their own asset preservation, whether it's DNR corrections or the universities.
So in 2014, was it 12 million that the department received?
10 million, Mr. Chairman.
And then 2 million for
buildings. The building.
I think it was 12 million. There's
two.
That was for Bemidji and Rochester. Facility. It was an identifiable building that was in Bemidji and also in Rochester. So it probably wasn't. Maybe it wasn't used specifically for asset preservation, but $10 million was. So it's pretty hard to get rid of $131 million when you get $10
million. Mr. Chairman, that's true. And if you look historically, there were many years where we only got $1 or $2 million for asset preservation. But we've made asset preservation a much higher priority for the department and have appreciated the recent funding and for asset preservation from the legislature.
Okay. And the governor's request this year for asset preservation for the department is what?
It's $20 million, Mr. Chairman.
$20 million. Okay.
In 2014, our request to through the process was for $50 million, and we were funded at 10.
So out of that $20 million, then that includes all of the items that you mentioned, such as roads, accesses, bridges, control structures.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to focus on buildings, but there will be some road work. There would be some trail work on the Sakata Trail and on Munger Bridges. There would be some money that goes towards forest roads. It really depends on what the final number is and how we can address the most critical needs. It's unlikely that we'd be spending much money on public accesses or on wildlife water control structures.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Lacasmo, what you're saying is you do have some money in the DNR for trails and for maintenance and repair of some of that, but you do not have any capital for any large repairs of buildings. That's what you're here requesting. So if, Mr. Chair, maybe this is a question for you, if we were to see that we got some building repair here and kind of set aside the trail repair, because there seems to be lots of dollars floating around for trails, between legacy and DNR funding and both rural metro and DNR funding and legacy money. Mr. Lacasmo, I'm a little bit familiar with the one you mentioned in Glenwood. What kind of a repair there are you requesting to do? That's a pretty big area there.
Mr. Lacasmo?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, what we're doing there is we're going to the existing office there for an area office, and there's a hatchery at Glenwood,
right,
is basically in the old residence, and we're going to demolish that residence and construct a new building. And we do, as far as, there are dollars in the agency budget to do the routine and the small repairs. I mean, the asset preservation is going towards the more large rehabilitation of a whole section of trail, not just filling cracks and potholes.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, where was this one trail that they're not using anymore because of the...
That's the Sakata Trail down between Waterville and... where is it? Lake Madison, between Lake Madison and Waterville.
Madison Lake, yeah.
Thank you.
It was one of the original trails that was built on an old railroad grade. And I think what you're seeing is the trail is very wavy now because of how they built on the old railroad grade without totally scarifying the base.
Do they have trail riders or users are they assessed like the snowmobile trails are? Is there any money that comes in from the users of the trails for trail maintenance?
Mr. Chairman, no. There's no specific account or additional charge.
All right. Okay. Any further?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, since you brought it up, and it's not a specific question, but just a comment and a seed I would like to plant. I've done it with I think both commissioners, certainly DNR's commissioner. A couple of years ago, the DNR facility in Rochester, you know, we have these rainstorms and so on and so forth, and as a result of that and leaking roofs and all that, the thing really became non-inhabitable. I mean, so they moved out. In fact, it's demolished. And they moved into a strip mall kind of situation. And it's probably working fine. I don't know. They'll have to comment about that if they ever want to. But the point I've made with the commissioner in which I hope that we can think of, if there ever is a new DNR facility in Rochester, my hope is it would be built in conjunction with the MnDOT facility. We have a brand new MnDOT facility there. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's a big garage, all that stuff. It's on 36 acres, and certainly MnDOT's used a good portion of that. But I'm not convinced that there wouldn't be room to build on that site and have that chemistry that we learned about in Bemidji a couple of years ago with DNR and MnDOT being able to work together on site. Cross desks, that kind of thing. I just think there's awful lot of advantages to that. So I just say that to plant a seed. We don't need to think about it this year, but for those on into the future that are here, if this ever comes to be, I hope we can have that conversation.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. I think that's absolutely true. I think for whatever reason, it seems like up in northwestern Minnesota, we're much more collaborative. Bemidji office, Thief River Falls office. We have the county highway department, the state highway department, public safety, the Department of Natural Resources, all in one building. But it did take some pushing to do that. But it works out very well because people go there and they can see all kinds of agencies, whatever they'd like.
Thank you.
So, all right, Senator Metzen.
Yeah, the $20 million, is that total for community projects, other projects, Red River Basin, and is that all inclusive of all of these items?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Metzen, the $20 million was for asset preservation for DNR facilities, for the DNR-owned buildings. And
have we talked about this sheet at all?
Not yet.
You're getting to this.
I'm getting to that one. Getting.
Okay. We will reserve my comments.
Mr. Lockesmo.
Mr. Chairman, and just to follow up on Senator Senjum's comments, I mean, one of the things that we're looking at, and certainly, like you mentioned, the Thief River Falls building is a good co-located facility. The new building we're building in Glenwood will have Department of Ag staff there. We do look at co-locating with other agencies as much as we can. In Rochester, we're still evaluating whether or not it makes sense to build, buy, or lease and what the options are. We have met with the PCA, and they would like to be co-located with us as we move forward. So we are having those conversations, and that's the right direction to go, Senator Senjum. I'll move on to flood hazard mitigation. The governor's request in the flood hazard mitigation is for $23.67 million. In this program, I know you're all aware, has been funded significantly over the last decade or so. And we've made significant progress with this program. Most of the the most repetitive flood loss communities are well protected now. East Grand Forks, Warren, Rosso project will be completed this year. Breckenridge is in its final phases. Moorhead, Austin has a project. And the money has been spread pretty much around the state. You'll see a map in your packet that shows the completed projects. There's 323 shown in red on your state map that are completed, and then there's 44 that are in progress of some phase. The specific request this year, if you look at the sheet that Senator Metzen was referring to, this list is the known projects that we were aware of as of March 5th of this year. So we've identified those. We put them on the list. The shading in green shows the projects that, if they were funded, could be completed. So the green highlights on this column show the projects that are on the way. And the governor's request this year includes funding for Oslo, Ada, Melrose, Climax, the Oakport Township, which is just on the north side of Moorhead, actually now incorporated into Moorhead, and the Otter Tail County Little McDonald Lake Project, and the Rosso River WMA Impoundment Project. So all told, those projects total the 23.67 million. The governor's bill includes funding for the Otter Tail project, Otter Tail County project. That's the lake outlets for Little McDonald Lake. At the time we put this list together, we took off their website the cost of the project. The latest estimates for that project cost were $10 million, and the governor's bill doesn't include a local match. So that's $10 million of the 23.67 would go towards the Otter Tail County project. And the other ones that I listed are shown in that first column that are under 2015 ready to go and would be completed. And as all of these projects, it seems the costs change. As you get bids, the overall cost may go up. That's what we've certainly seen this last year.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Sir, you mentioned that the governor has indicated $23 million of this money. He's kind of earmarked them. Is that what I heard you say?
No, Mr.
What I'm really getting at is there's three or four or five voluntary acquisitions on here that I know these communities have been using, Newport, Denver Grove Heights, and some others. And do you envision that there will be money at the end of the day? I mean, it's been a wonderful program. I mean, in Denver Grove Heights and Newport, they've been taking down a couple, two, three buildings in the floodplain each and every year for about the last 7-8 years, and it's worked very well. So I just hate to see it all used up.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, the way the governor's bill is drafted, it provides the $23.67 million. It doesn't specifically identify dollar numbers for each project. It also provides the DNR, the ability to set priorities, and we always have been, it's always been a very high priority for us to acquire the flood-prone properties, remove them from the floodplain so you don't have to worry about protecting them in the future. So we've generally been able to find the dollars for these individual or the one-off acquisitions, if you will.
Mr. Chairman, I could only speak for Denver Grove Heights, but I mean, in the floodplain, down there, they've been acquiring, if for sale or if they're available, I believe two or three houses a year. It has been working very well, and we're going to have Heritage Park down there pretty soon, and it's a big deal, at least for that area, Inver Grove. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question along that line. I see a lot of funding proposals here for levies. Is that kind of pushing the water downstream, if I may say, or is there other mitigation factors like Senator Metzen talked about allowing a floodplain that's part of the plan?
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Pappas, You know, in a lot of areas, a levy is one of the structural means that you need to employ, because you can't store enough water upstream, you can't manage the flood that way. So it does increase the stage potentially upstream and downstream slightly. So we do look at that. And for the Red River Valley, for example, I'm sure you've seen pictures of those floods where it spreads out for miles and miles. So running it through, or constructing a ring levee around a town like Oslo doesn't significantly raise the flood stage downstream.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question with regards to the McDonald project. So what this is telling me, then, the total project is 83, and the state's obligation would be under this bill, 4.15. Is that going to finish the project?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, when we put this together, that was the price that we found on their website, and since then, that project has developed more, and we've become more familiar with what the total costs are. And right now, the total cost to finish that project or to construct it is $10 million. And within the governor's bill language, it would fund the entire $10 million. The local governments, the local lake improvement districts, have somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million that they've already invested in the engineering and the design.
Senator Ingebrigtsen doesn't include the personal damages to the properties at all.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Is there ever consideration for that? I'm sorry, Mr.
Mr. Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that does not account to any personal damages or any losses that individuals may have occurred or incurred.
Is your question on this particular project, or Senator Stephen? Okay, I want to just on the that particular project. I stopped and looked at it, and there isn't total unanimous support, especially is it downstream. Could you explain a little bit more what's happening there? And if do they have a watershed district there that is kind of the lead agency in terms of, you know, let's say public meetings or hearings or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, there is not a watershed district there. There are two lake improvement districts. And then the county government has also been somewhat involved. The issue is these are landlocked lakes. They don't have an outlet. So as it's been extremely wet in that area of the state, these lake levels have risen significantly. They're now, you know, about 4 feet over the ordinary high water level. So they've, you know, flooded numerous homes around the lake. If they continue to rise, there's more homes that are threatened. For the downstream interests, the lakes that may have higher water levels are in this. They don't want to see any additional water, and they certainly don't want to see any invasive species. There were zebra mussels that were found about 3 years ago. They haven't been found since, but we would still have the outlet would have a screen to avoid the potential transfer of any exotics or invasives downstream. So the downstream interests are worried about two things: higher water levels and the invasives. The invasives are managed through the construction of a filter system, and this is a pumped system, so if water levels are high downstream, they would have an operation plan that would limit the amount that's pumped from these lakes.
Okay, so the department is really kind of the lead agency or the
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have certainly permits, environmental review that would be done as part of this project.
Okay. All right, Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lacasmo, could you help us understand what projects the governor listed in his request and why there are some? It seems to me that just looking at this little priority column, there are some A priority. projects that weren't included in some B ones that were. Why not just start with A and then finish those off and then move to B? Or is it because of the year they're ready or what?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sieben, as we put the list together and added priorities on there, that was to give an idea of which projects were ready to go and were in the midst of construction. Afton specifically in the is not included in the governor's list, and there's a limited dollars and how far they can they can be spread among these projects. There is significantly more demand than we've had funding for in recent years. And Afton is an ongoing project. I know the committee was out there last year. They have about, I think, $1.6 million of a grant right now that they're working on. So whether or not they need additional monies this year was part of the consideration of why they weren't on that list. They also have to fully meet their non-state match, which they're in the process of doing. So we looked at the projects that were listed in the governor's bill as the ones that could finish this year and that are ready to go.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Lacusmo, you know this, but for the committee, that non-state match can be quite a stretch for some cities. Like Afton, it's only 3,000 some people. So to come up with that local match is really significant and really puts an incredible burden on property taxpayers. So that's something that we need to be mindful of for smaller cities, is even if their relative property wealth is somewhat greater than some of the other cities listed, it's still a really significant burden to come up with that local match.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, the language in the bills in recent years and included in the governor's proposal have limited the local match to the 2% of the median household income, or it's 50-50 if that's a cheaper option. So the legislature has provided some relief to just a straight 50-50 match for communities.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, so when I'm assuming when the administration puts together their budget, that they're considering some pretty serious things like dollars for mitigation and dollars for projects like we just got done talking about the four lakes where the property damage has been so extensive that, I mean, we've got people that aren't even coming to their cabins, they're just abandoning their cabins because of the four-foot level flooding stage. So I'm assuming that's what the administration is saying, that we probably need to take care of those before we do any mitigation. Is that a fair statement? Mitigation's always good because we can prevent something from happening, but we've already got something here that, so I'm assuming that he's thinking that's pretty serious.
Mr. Lacusmore.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, certainly the current plight of landowners is a consideration in the funding decisions. This is an ongoing flood at Little McDonald Lakes, and whether or not we have excess precipitation this year or drought conditions will dictate whether that lake goes up or down. If it goes up, there's going to be more homes flooded. So this project would provide mitigation to avoid those damages.
Okay. Should we move along? Dam safety?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. In the dam safety area, the governor's request was for $4.575 million. And this goes to repair state-owned dams and to provide cost-share grants to the local or other publicly-owned dams. The DNR prepares a priority list by June 1st of each odd-numbered years. The priority list that you have in your packet has a different date on it because we had completed some inspections and updated the list based on the findings of those inspections. The There's about 800 dams in the state that fall under the dam safety program. About half are owned by the state and half by local units of government. What we do is we do inspect the high hazard dams annually. Those are the dams that have the potential for loss of life or significant property damage if they were to fail. So if you look on the, well, there's 34 high hazard dams in the state that the federal government owns two of them, the state owns two, the local government owns 25, and there are three in private ownership. The two in state ownership, New London Dam is one of those, which was recently completed, a rehabilitation project there. And the other one is the Lake Bronson Dam at Lake Bronson State Park. That one we're in the process of doing the engineering for, to do the design for a fix. The estimated cost is going to be somewhere between $5 and $9 million, but we'll know more after the engineering studies are completed. That was the number one project on our priority list. The Drayton Dam on the Red River near Drayton, North Dakota, is that's going to be a multi-party project with both states and numerous other watershed districts and other organizations. So that one's and that one could be mitigation for the Fargo-Moorhead flood project. So that one's not quite ready to be funded. And that, as you note on the list, is only a medium priority dam, but it is a drowning machine dam that you could have loss of life if people get caught in the roll or below the dam. Then the next four dams on our priority list are all high hazard dams that should be addressed. Those include St. Cloud, Pelican Rapids, Norway Lake, and an impoundment near Canby. And this project would fund all four of those. It also funds the Lanesboro Dam, which you don't see Lanesboro on this priority list because we had funded Lanesboro in previous appropriations, and we had funded at that point 50% of the estimated project cost. That's what the law provides for, so we didn't show it on the priority list below. Lanesboro is a community that would struggle coming up with their half of the project cost. That's estimated to be around $1.9 million for the Lanesboro Dam. So included in this, in the governor's bill, is full funding to complete the Lanesboro Dam repair.
Is that dam generate electricity?
Mr. Chairman, no. Okay. It, you know, it did at one time. I believe the committee also stopped at Lanesboro and saw the dam. And one of the things that with that dam is it is a historical dam, and to keep it in the same condition and restore it and address that, that's going to cost more. So at one point they did have a grant from the Historical Society to assist with that. I'm not sure if that grant is continuing or not.
So does that mean that the water that's coming right through the wall of the dam, you're going to leave that continue, or?
Mr. Chairman, no, I think they'll correct those deficiencies, but they will keep the stone in the same look of that dam that exists today.
Okay. Chairman.
All right. Senator Metzen.
What's the status of the dam in Lake Bilsby?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzen, Dakota County is the owner of that dam, and they've been doing repairs. They did a major overflow spillway repair, and we did just provide them a grant to do some other rehabilitation that they have identified. So, to the best of our knowledge, that project is fully funded, and Dakota County has paid their or is paying their 50% of the project cost.
Thank you very much.
All right, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, before we left the Lanesboro Dam, I just wanted to make a brief comment that I appreciated the chair's comment, too, about the holes in that dam. That is the holiest dam I've ever seen. And the water coming through that is quite remarkable. So I'm very glad to see that it's in the governor's proposal. But, Mr. Lacasmo, you did discuss why it's not listed here as a priority item, but it is a priority item. It just isn't on your list. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, if you look in the top part of the page on the priority list, underfunded is Lanesboro for $450,000. And if you go down into the budgeted columns, the last budgeted column before the middle of the line is Lanesboro at $300,000. So we felt that that $750,000 was half of the total cost of reconstruction. So because that's what the law allows, I wasn't going to add it on a priority list looking for additional funding because it would be inconsistent with existing law.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lacasmo, maybe you can help me recall, you know, we've, for the benefit of the audience, several of us have seen this on several occasions, but the plan is to keep the historical dam, if you will, as I recall, and then build a dam upstream, if that's correct. And but I'm trying to recall, you know, you build a stream upstream, you're still going to have water coming through the river. How are we going to protect the historic dam? I'm missing something in my process here. We're going to have water on the backside of that dam, aren't we, the historic dam?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum, now I'm not sure on the exact design of the reconstruction, but basically, if you're going to keep the face of the dam as it looking like it does now, you're going to have to do the construction work on the upstream side to seal it. So I believe that, but I can check on the current status and provide that to the committee. I'm not exactly sure what that design is.
Mr. Chair, it would seem like, you know, any dam, aesthetically, you want a little water coming over the edge of it. And,
and some trout.
And some trout.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum, there will be water coming over the dam. It just hopefully will stop it from going through the dam.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But, Mr. Chair, my understanding
Senator
was
Senjum.
They were going to, well, maybe to do some tuck pointing on it, but that the old dam would kind of stay as was, you know, with some level of repair. Anyway, we could just get that later on.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, that's all I had on those specific items, unless there are other committee questions.
Okay. All right. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very interesting discussion. One of the things on the flood risk reduction projects, it's a sheet that has the map with the blue and the red dots. And so it looks like a lot of good work has been done. Some more is ongoing. But I was trying to find there must be those not done or not started. This is completed or in process. And so is there a list that goes with this that are the not done? Is that the one like this?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, essentially the in progress are the ones that we know about that are that have been identified on this other list. So there may be others that materialize, but we've known, you know, since the floodplain program's been around since 1969, we know where those flood risks are in the state, and we're addressing those. What you're seeing now is more significant flood events, and other areas seeking flood mitigation.
I just think, Mr. Chairman, to just
Senator
say
Kiffmeyer.
A lot of work has been done. Minnesota has put a lot into this whole project of flood mitigation, and I see a lot of red dots. So certainly I know there may be some of those new ones, because sometimes when you do some work, something else crops up or a heavy storm shows something that wasn't there before. I just think it's just good to recognize that we've done a lot and a lot of progress has been made while we continue to work to take care of others needed, but at least we can recognize the good work done. Thank you.
One project that isn't on here that I believe there was a bill introduced was on the flood that took place down in Steele County, I believe. And this is a number or a few years ago. Can you just give us a little insight on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the I believe you're referring to the bill that would fund the Steele County's public works facility.
Yes.
And from my understanding of that project, and it was flooded in 2010 with those event, or that event. And My understanding is that they are now looking at reconstructing their public works facility at a new site out of the floodplain. And the bill that was introduced has money going to deed, which would be appropriate. It doesn't strike me that that project is a flood hazard mitigation project.
Even though it was declared a federal or a disaster declaration?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And I believe the county is going to get some FEMA reimbursement for the damages, and they can apply those to a new building. But for the reconstruction of the damaged facilities, we haven't paid for that type of work under the flood hazard mitigation program. We would provide for levees or flood walls or that kind of construction, but not reconstructing buildings.
So if in a flood the local government wants to move a building, the moving of the building wouldn't necessarily negate the flood mitigation help that they would receive through these programs, would it?
Mr. Chairman, if it's a public building, you could I expect you could relocate that with bond dollars. When we've looked at relocations, because you need to relocate to place a levee, if they're private homes, the local government buys the homes, they may be relocated. So I'm not exactly sure if I got in your question, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Locksmith, I was just wondering if in the case of their situation, their courthouse got flooded, I believe, and rather than raise it up to the new standard that FEMA wanted, they decided to move it. Is it the moving of that courthouse that would result in them not being eligible for program or the help through the state flood mitigation program, or is it the something else?
Mr. Chairman, it's their public works facility, not the courthouse.
Okay.
And they're going to build a brand new facility. It's not moving the old buildings that are in existence. They would ultimately be demolished on site. There may be some parts of what they're doing that could qualify for flood hazard mitigation, but the bulk of the project is to build a new public works facility.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Locksmo.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And I think next we'll invite up Margaret Donahoe and John Well. Is it Welly? And Senator Scott Dibble. If you'd all kind of join us up there, and maybe Senator Dibble, if you can kind of give us an overview of the transportation. Have you resolved the conference committee already? And with the House and
yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the House is just going to concur with the Senate position, and we're all set. So, Mr. Chair, I'll give a very quick overview. Still waiting on a couple numbers because I don't keep these in my head, and I didn't have time to run up to the office to grab them. But as you are aware, and the committee is aware, many years working on the bonding bill. The role of bonding in supporting our transportation infrastructure is pretty important from year to year. We look to general obligation bonds, GO bonds, to support our non-trunk highway efforts, supplement in many ways. Of course, and what I'm talking about in terms of roads and bridges are those that are owned and controlled by local jurisdictions. And then transit as well, mostly in the metropolitan area. I don't know if we've ever actually bonded for transit purposes for Greater Minnesota Transit or not. But we also look to bonding sometimes to support airport efforts, port efforts, and those sorts of things. The initial bill that the Senate introduced had a fairly fairly strong position with general obligation bonds, just as a way of trying to illustrate the need. We, of course, immediately deleted those in the second iteration of that when we presented the actual markup bill to committee, but we just wanted to at least make a statement and be responsive to the need that had been identified through the work of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee. And I have those numbers here that I can quote to you, and then I'll remind you what we had proposed in the initial outset of the Transportation Finance Bill, the Transportation Initiative. And then at some point in the not-too-distant future, maybe after Margaret goes, or maybe Margaret has this stuff memorized, she can talk about the relative size, the mileage of the state highway system and the proportion of transportation that it takes. Oh, here we are. And then at some point I'm going to be reminded exactly what we have in the version of the bill in terms of ongoing local bridge and road and other forms of transportation support. So the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, as you recall, had kind of three different scenarios that they mapped out what we would need to support our transportation system just to keep it in a state of relatively decent repair. And there's a funding gap identified just to do that. But we would need to just a small increment to maintain system performance over the next 20 years. So what we need to do to catch up, what we need to do for the next 20 years, and then what we would need to do to be economically competitive. For our county system, just to kind of maintain our current level of system performance over the next 20 years, there is an annual funding gap identified of about $200 million. If we want to be world-class economically competitive, an annual funding gap of $450 million. This is just for the county road system. Not all of that, of course, has to come from GO bonds. There's a variety of sources. Some of it flows through the formula. Some of it comes through local effort. Some might come through cash allocations, new sources of revenue. Some might be supported through our bonding program. Township roads, not a ton of need identified, but some effort, and we do improve our effort in the bill that I proposed. And the dollars we get to township roads come through the formula, through the gas tax, et cetera, through the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. For city roads, for the municipal state aid system, and remember, municipal state aid only flows to cities of a population 5,000 and above. Oh, thank you. Here's my phone a friend here. maybe I'll have you help present that in a second. We identified about a $250 million annual funding gap just to kind of maintain current system performance, $400 million to be economically competitive. For Greater Minnesota Transit, a $10 million annual funding gap to maintain current system performance, $45 million per year. Pretty significant. A lot of that is driven, of course, by the aging population, but also a real desire to really keep and retain workers in local communities, particularly regional centers. But deep rural also has some fairly significant transit needs. Passenger rail, that's intercity passenger or intra-city passenger rail. We also have some efforts if we're ever going to connect by a passenger rail to Chicago and other places. A couple of significant projects in mind, particularly connecting up through up to Duluth, down to Rochester, $250 to $350 million annual funding gap. For our freight rail and our ports, $15 million to maintain current system performance, $30 million per year to be economically competitive. Just another little piece of background. The state highways account for 8% of all the roadway miles, so that means 92% of all the roads in the state are owned by local jurisdictions, owned and operated by local jurisdictions, so counties, cities, large and small, yeah, as well as townships. But interestingly, state highways account for 58% of all traffic. So that tells you kind of the relative amount of vehicle miles traveled on the state highway system. 8% of all roadway miles, 58% of all traffic. Let's see. 34% of the roadways are under county jurisdiction. That represents 45,000 miles and 41% of vehicle miles traveled in the state. Now, the county system, recall, is divided into two systems, the county state aid highways. Those are the major roadways owned by the counties that carry a lot of city-to-city traffic, and the county road system, supported primarily by the county property taxes. Wheelage taxes and locally generated sales taxes also support the county roads system. Then the municipal streets make up 14% of roadways in Minnesota, and that's 19,000 miles and 14% of vehicle miles traveled. So 14% of the roadways, 14% of the vehicle miles traveled. And that's two systems, the municipal state aid system, again, supported in part through gas tax or highway user tax distribution fees. I say gas tax, but that's not true. It's gas tax, license tag fees, and motor vehicle sales tax that flow through the highway user tax distribution system to assist with the major arterials in our cities above 5,000, and then the city street system supported almost entirely by property taxes. So that gives you the relative proportions, and then there's township roads and bridges and the like. Maybe I'll ask Ms. Berezovsky, because I'm not going to try to decipher these notes. Who's going to share with you quickly what we have presently in the bill, and then I wanted to share with you just a little bit. We had a whole series of 3 days of hearings, hearing all the individual projects, just to give you a sense of the proportion of individual projects proposed for the for bonding or cash or you know, kind of earmark, which we don't do, but it just gives you, it's illustrative. So our current bill.
Mr. Chair, Bonnie Berezovsky, Senate Council. I have some numbers here that from our fiscal analyst as to what is in House File 4, which has passed the Senate floor. And this has to do with local roads and how they're funded in the bill. So for county state aid highways, there is $288 million over base, and this is largely from increased tax rates and a new tax in the bill. Municipal state aid streets, $102 million over base. And these are biennial numbers. So in addition to tax increases, this is generated by a redistribution of 5% of the highway user tax distribution fund. The county municipal account will gain $4.7 million. Then there is for small non-state aid cities that are under 5,000 in population, there's $57 million from surcharges that are redirected to these small cities. Then the larger cities over 5,000 that do get state aid, there's also $57 million from the surcharges, from new surcharges that are imposed in the bill. The town roads and bridges are $22 million over base, and that is from the increased and new taxes in the bill. Local bridge replacement, 10.75 general fund one-time money from the committee target, or the division target, rather. Safe routes to school infrastructure, $2.5 million a year, and that is ongoing general fund. And highways on tribal lands, $5 million one-time general fund.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll finish up quickly here. I'll back up a step. I think I had promised to talk about what we had proposed in the initial bill that we've taken out in terms of GO bonds. So what we had initially proposed was $300 million to support local bridges in GO bonds, $100 million in local road improvements, $5 million for at-grade railroad crossing improvements, $122 million for railroad grade separation projects, and then $10 million each for the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Fund, and that makes improvements to the Class 2 and smaller railroads around the state, the trackage, for intercity passenger rail, for water ports, and for airports. And I just wanted to did we hand out the document?
Document.
So at your place is is a matrix of all of the different transit and roadway bills that were introduced individually, most of which, or all of which, we heard in front of the committee. So you can just read that at your leisure. But that just shows you kind of what's out there in terms of locally identified opportunities, needs, aspirations, dreams, goals. And we had a wonderful series of hearings to hear about what folks are working on at the local level, and just gives you some guidance.
It's actually staggering, you know, when you start looking at all of the need and the projected costs. You know, it's very humbling to think that a modest bonding bill could even play a little piece in that if you didn't have a transportation funding package.
It's pretty significant. And then finally, I just wanted to spend 1 second talking about a lot of what I heard about as I traveled around the state talking to locals, business people, and elected officials at the city and county level, and the local the dollars that we generate, whether they come through bonding or come through cash or new sources, particularly around bridges, that when we have large bridges in the metropolitan area, what they call budget buster bridges, we'll designate a pot of money from wherever for local bridges, and then these big bridges will come in and just absorb all the dollars in one fell swoop, and leaving very little for the local bridge needs to be supported outside of our regular formula basis. And they just wanted us to be cognizant of that and maybe start thinking about the large bridges separately. And so we did set up actually a large bridge account in the bill. We established this kind of a separate account with the idea maybe we could direct dollars into that account, so then they wouldn't compete directly head to head with spreading some dollars around to improve the county, city, and township bridges.
I think that's right. An excellent idea. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, as you were discussing the gaps in the different types of funding streams or projects, I'm sure that's written down somewhere so I can get that. But I want to know if you could tell me, how do those funding gaps, identified funding gaps, compare with the TFAC report and those funding gaps? Because I think there's a difference. And it'd be helpful if you could identify what those differences are and why.
Senator Dill.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, I might not have been... I might have jumped over it quick. That is the TFAC report that I was citing.
The TFAC report.
And
okay.
I can Xerox this and send it around to the...
Yes, that'd be great.
Great. Thank you. Well, should we dive into the local roads and bridges? Ms. Donahoe?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Dibble?
We also identified some additional resources through an assessment on the Class 1 railroads of $35 million a year. $65 million over the biennium for the purpose of paying for a couple of different things, but mostly to pay for railroad crossings, both at grade and grade separated. That's in the present bill. I just wanted to mention that.
Okay. Ms. Donahoe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. And I want to thank Senator Dibble for putting together the transportation funding bill that passed the Senate. We really, really appreciate all of the committee's work in putting that together, because the state absolutely needs an increase in the constitutionally dedicated user fees that we have that go into the Highway Trust Fund. And without that, we will continue to see many more lists and lists of projects that will not get done. MnDOT has put together a 20-year highway investment plan, and a lot of the projects you see in the bills that were introduced are not in that 20-year plan. That's largely why legislators introduced those bills, because they're not programmed. And without additional revenue into the Trunk Highway Fund, the state is not in a position to issue any additional trunk highway bonds, because MnDOT has established a debt service limit of 20%. of the Trunk Highway Fund, and we're pretty much at that. So unless we have some more revenue, we won't be able to see an authorization of trunk highway bonds and to see those projects move forward. The state projects are the ones that need trunk highway bonds, but general obligation bonds can be used for local roads and local bridges. And those are programs that local governments have really come to depend on and really look to as they struggle, as you've heard, with this gap of need to try to maintain the systems that they have. And really that's a lot of what we're talking about is a gap just to take care of the transportation system that we have today, let alone to try and expand it or improve it or deal with some of the safety problems that we have. So we've provided some handouts for you, and one of them looks like this. Talks about the distribution of the GO bond proceeds that were provided in 2014 for the local bridge program. And again, the local bridge program has been around for many years and has almost always been funded in just about every bonding bill that has been passed in recent years. And that continuity is also really important because it does take, as you know, years of planning and preparation to get these projects ready to be let for construction. And so to the degree that local governments can count on this funding, they come up with their own funding, they do design work, they get projects ready to go. And so you can see how those funds were distributed. There's $33 million provided. That $33 million leveraged about $60 million worth of projects. So what you see on this list is not the total project cost. What you see in terms of the dollar amount is just the bond part of the project. And really, in transportation, when you look at any individual project, there's almost always a combination of revenue sources and programs that went into funding that project. So it really is a partnership that involves federal funds, state funds, local funds, all coming together to get an individual project done. So the bond proceeds that are provided by the legislature through the bonding bill allow many more millions of dollars worth of projects to get done. And again, you have a handout that shows how the funding for the local road improvement program was distributed. Last session, there was about $54 million in cash and bonds provided for the local road improvement program. That leveraged, as you can see, about $145 million worth of local road projects. So again, the state GO bond dollars combine with federal funds and local funds to get a lot of work done. So it really is a critical piece of the funding puzzle that we really need to see continue. And right now, both of these programs are, of course, out of money. The money that was provided has been spent. For the local bridge program, there is a waiting list of bridges that are ready to go. But unless there's some additional funding provided for the program, those bridges will wait. And if they have to wait another construction year, of course, those costs will increase for those projects. So I also wanted to mention there is a bill that was introduced by Senator Vicki Jensen in the Senate, Representative Jeff Howe in the House, that provides $200 million for the local bridge program and $200 million for the local road improvement program in GO bonds. We have lists and lists of needs that we've provided some of that. But also just to let you know that the Office of State Aid at MnDOT does maintain a master bridge list looking out numerous years. And if we look at all of the bridges, there are over 1,100 bridges on the master list right now. And that goes out to 2018, 2019. But all of those bridges total about $443 million. So looking out at the next few years, there is definitely a big need for funds for both local roads and local bridges. And in addition to increasing the funding in the Highway Trust Fund, these programs are also really critical to helping local governments maybe keep down their property taxes and get some of these really critical projects done. Because bridges can be really expensive for local governments. If it's even a small bridge in a rural area, for those smaller local governments, a bridge can be a big part of their budget that they may not be able to figure out how to pay for. In the metro area, we've seen local bridges like the Kellogg Bridge in St. Paul that needs $40 million. It's hard to see how local governments can come up with those kinds of dollars without some kind of state assistance. And I guess I would just close by mentioning that there is a bridge report that we've also provided that shows both state and local deficient bridges. We have about 850 deficient bridges in Minnesota today. And at the back of this report, it breaks down where those bridges are located by county. And so we, again, do have a big need for bridge funding. And the last sort of piece of the puzzle that is also important is the wetland mitigation program under Bowser that also helps local governments as they deal with these local road projects to pay for the cost of wetland mitigation. Right now, I think there's an immediate need for about $5 million for that program, and then in the next year, about $16 million. And that, again, is another piece of all these different funding sources that come together that allow these local road and bridge projects to get done. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's nice and concise. Again, staggering amounts. I mean, it's just you just wonder how the state can ever get on top of this or how all of us can ever get on top of it. Senator Metzen had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Donahoe, would you run by that 20% cap that you mentioned earlier and how that number was determined and why that can't be upped to provide more dollars for projects? I didn't get the full drift of that explanation.
Sure.
Could you just reframe the question?
Yeah, please.
On what topic? Ms. Donahoe?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, thank you. Yes, you may recall, I think it was back in the 2008 transportation funding bill, there was a requirement by the legislature that MnDOT set a policy for debt service. So just as the state has a policy for debt service out of the general fund that helps the legislature determine how large of a bonding bill the legislature and the state can support, the legislature thought that MnDOT should also have a policy. So because the dollars that go into the Trunk Highway Fund, according to the Constitution, are supposed to be used for a highway purpose. And so we don't want to have too much of that money going to pay debt service on bonds because that's money that can't be used for construction. So by setting a limit on debt service, we can manage the money in the Trunk Highway Fund to make sure that we're not spending too much on debt service versus road construction. And MnDOT determined, looking at other states and the FHWA guidelines and those kinds of things, that about a 20% limit made sense, so that no more than 20% of the total funds in the Trunk Highway Fund would go for debt service on bonds versus maintenance and road construction and other activities. And right now, because of previous bond authorizations for trunk highway bonds, we're pretty much at that level of almost 20% of money out of the Trunk Highway Fund today is going to pay debt service on previously authorized trunk highway bonds.
But, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of a catch-22 because you're building the projects and the debt service, you see, isn't used for something else, but at the same token, it did a lot of projects at the beginning. Is that correct? So, I mean,
yes.
It's kind of a two-edged sword there the way I see it. I mean, you say the debt service is high, and you can't use it for other things. But at the same token, you got the other projects funded. So I, you know, that's like I'm my own grandpa. You know, I just.
Yeah. One other facet to it is that the trunk highway bonds also count against the state capacity, and when I saw Senator Dibble's bill on the floor. Adding $200 million, which was really needed, obviously, but that would have eaten up the state capacity significantly over a 10-year period. I believe it's a 10-year period that it was. So we need the capacity. And obviously, I think if the bill becomes law in and the new revenue is generated, that alone will help solve some of the problem because of the debt service and everything. So,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, you answered my question. It was about debt capacity and how it relates to our total bonding.
All right. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, on that subject, I did spend some time with Commissioner Franz and other professional staff at MMB last week, who took me through an explanation of how the overall Trunk Highway Fund program, if supported by new revenue, would impact the efforts of this committee in terms of the general obligation bonding program. The short version is it wouldn't in any way, because the additional revenue would be raised, and the size of any bonding bills that are under consideration, both for this year and for next year, if that were to happen, a 2015 and a 2016 bonding bill wouldn't be really impinged in any way. So that was, I think, good news. I know that was a particular focus of concern of Senator Pappas as well as yourself. And I think you've had that same discussion with Commissioner Franz.
Okay. Mr. Welly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is John Welly. I am the Aiken County Engineer, and I am also the current president of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. For those of you that don't know, our association has been in existence for over 70 years, and we are represented by the county engineers of all 87 counties, as well as their engineering staff. Thank you for allowing time on today's agenda to talk a little bit about two bonding programs that are very vital to counties. Those two programs are, as Margaret mentioned earlier, the local bridge replacement program and the local road improvement program. Now, these programs are both so important to counties because they are something that helps counties deal with the huge transportation funding problem that we have in all of our counties. As you know, counties receive 29% of the funds that are distributed through the Highway Users Distribution Fund. But that revenue over the years, in the last decade, thanks largely to the 2008 transportation bill, the revenue that's distributed to counties through the Highway User Fund has increased by a third. Unfortunately, during that same time frame, our construction needs on our systems has increased more than twofold. Our construction costs have increased more than twofold. So therein lies a gap of funding. Our costs are going up. The revenue is not keeping pace. We have an immediate need, and the really bad news, I guess, is that the disparity or the gap is widening. We continue to lose pace all the time with our revenue. We're falling farther and farther behind without additional revenue. The main reason, of course, that the state aid revenue is not keeping up is the gasoline tax that we collect and distribute through the user trust fund. That gas tax simply does not keep up with inflation. The 28 cents per gallon generates the same amount of revenue when gasoline is at prices like today at around $2.50 a gallon. It generates the same amount when gasoline climbs to $4 a gallon. So the revenue stays the same, but one thing we know when motor fuels increase is that our cost of construction increases, and that largely is what is making, over the past decade, our costs increase more than twofold. At the same time that state aid revenues are not keeping pace, our federal funds have actually been slashed under MAP 21. MAP 21 is the latest federal highway bill that's been in place for a few years now, and many of the area transportation partnerships throughout the state have slashed the funding available to counties for their highway projects by 50%. So that is, that's something that we're dealing with as well. Now, in 2008, this legislature did give counties the local options of local option sales tax and the wheelage tax, and those local option funding sources have been very good for a lot of counties. I think there's probably about 10 counties that have implemented the local option sales tax. I think there's over half that have implemented the wheelage tax. So they have been good. Those programs have been good for the counties that have been able to enact them and to utilize the funds that they get from them. The problem with those two programs is just that it's non-comprehensive. There's still a lot of counties that if you have a small population county or if you don't have a lot of retail base, the money that's generated in your county by those two local option sources just is not that significant. And therefore, you know, that's the reason that a lot of counties, especially small rural counties like the county that I'm from, just have not been able to take advantage of those programs. Which leads us to these two bonding programs, the Local Road Improvement Program and the Local Bridge Replacement Program. And I think in that backdrop, it really explains why these two programs are so important to counties, especially the counties that just don't have a lot of other options when it comes to funding. A lot of counties, like my own county, really the only option we have to address our transportation shortfall is property taxes. And we right now are considering a bonding program that will be backed by property taxes to help fund some of our gap. So the funding crisis that we're seeing, what it invariably results in is project delay. Basically, most local governments, as I said, they don't have a lot of options. So if money isn't there to replace bridges or to rehab pavements, the projects simply get delayed. You can see from this sheet that I think was handed out, this is a complete listing of all of the counties' projects. Well, excuse me, not all of the counties' projects. I think 52 of the counties responded. Projects on here total, I think, $1.2 billion. These are projects that counties could deliver in a very short time frame if the funding was available. For my county personally, you'll see right at the top of the list there, and the only reason it's at the top of the list is because alphabetically we're first. But we have 8 projects on there that are listed at an amount of about $7 million. These projects are all pavement projects that basically we have missed the life cycle of these pavements. We are past the appropriate time to rehab these pavements. Especially with pavement rehabilitation, you have a time frame where you can do the most cost-effective fix to that pavement. And if you miss that time frame, as you go forward, when that project is delayed, the costs become higher. That thin mill and overlay that perhaps would have been adequate at the end of its life cycle is no longer adequate. So now you're looking at a much more substantial project and a much more expensive project. The result of project delays when it comes to bridges is quite simply that we, more times than not, end up with another posted bridge on our system. And we have a lot of posted bridges on our system, and I'll talk about that here in a bit. But posted bridges, when we post a bridge on our system, what it really indicates is a failure to provide a system-wide transportation network, because we can have a 10-ton road leading up to that bridge. We can have a 10-ton road leading away from it. But if we have a bridge that won't carry a legal truck, we have a bottleneck in the system. And we have that situation all over the state on our local systems, especially more so lately. I'll talk about that in just a minute. So at the same time that counties are dealing with all of these funding issues, private industry, the public, is also looking for an increase in service from our highways. Status quo isn't good enough anymore. We see that industry is constantly wanting to haul heavier loads on our highways, and that's fine. As county engineers, we realize the benefits of being able to haul heavier loads. Heavier loads will result in more efficiency, lower cost for the end user. That's a good thing. The problem is simply that we don't have a system, because of underinvestment for a long period of time, we don't have a system of roads that can carry these heavier loads. But we still continue to be under pressure from industry to increase those loads. The other thing that has happened in the industry that has really affected our bridges in the past, say, decade or so, is that the industry has learned that By taking the same truck and just adding more axles, they can haul more weight legally in compliance with all of our laws regarding weight. That's why you see a lot of these trucks that really look like tandem axle dump trucks. They have a fourth axle on them or a fifth axle or even a sixth and seventh axle. They put those axles on because then under the weights that are in statute, they're able to put more weight on that same vehicle. The vehicle didn't get any physically longer in most cases. They just added more axles, and they can put more weight on that vehicle. Now, when this started happening about a decade ago, we realized that these vehicles are something that a lot of our local bridges simply are not capable of carrying. These vehicles weren't around in the 1950s and 1960s and 1970s when our bridges were designed, so they were never designed for these bridges. For these vehicles. When these vehicles started becoming prevalent on our highway systems, MnDOT, in cooperation with us, did a bunch of statewide bridge rating programs. And what we've learned from those bridge rating programs is that we have a large number of bridges on our system. I don't have the exact number for you. I could get that. But we have a large number of bridges, in addition to the 830 structurally deficient bridges on our system, that simply cannot handle those increased loads, and they now are posted against those higher loads. We have seen a sharp increase in bridge postings on our local highway systems in the past 5 to 10 years as we have rated our bridges for these new special hauling vehicles is what they're called. So we have a lot of posted bridges out there. So with the lack of funding, with the new expectations from the public, it's no surprise that we have a huge backlog of local projects that could be funded through the LRIP and bridge bonding programs. And that, again, is as evidenced by this handout that totals $1.2 billion from 50 counties. We certainly appreciate the past support by the legislature of the Local Road Improvement Program and the Local Bridge Replacement Program. Those programs have been absolutely vital in the wake of everything else that's happening on the funding front. They have been vital to at least enable us to move some projects forward. But I would speak to the need, especially with the bridge bonding program, to be able to have that program operate as a continuous program, as opposed to in 2014, for example. There was money allocated, and I think by the time the waiting list bridges, in other words, bridges that were all done and just waiting to be funded, by the time those bridges got funded, the money was gone. And, in fact, I don't think we even got through the waiting list last time around. So as we sit right now, as Margaret said, we are short of bridge bonding money. There is no bridge bonding money, and we basically are at a standstill, not able to move any bridges forward. So that's all I have. I'd stand for questions.
Okay. Thank you. If you look at the two programs, and I know sometimes you kind of put the same amount in each area or each category, where is it the bridge account that you see as being the most important or most imminent, or both of them? I realize that both are important, but where would you put the greater emphasis?
Mr. Chair, speaking for all of the counties, I would say that they're equally important. You know, not all counties have deficient bridges. Of the 87 counties, there are some counties that have no bridge needs but have very high road needs and, you know, other sorts of needs that can be funded through the Local Road Improvement Program. There are also counties that have many, many structurally deficient bridges. So to emphasize one over the other, I guess depending on which county you're talking about, it's going to vary. But as a whole, they're both very important. We need the bridge bonding program. Like I said, it needs to be funded at a program or at a size that will allow the program to operate continuously for the biennium. And if we don't do that, if we don't provide enough funds for it to operate throughout the biennium and for bridge projects to be able to move forward throughout the biennium, what we create is this situation where there are no funds available, so there are no bridge projects being let. From our standpoint, obviously, as local governments, we're not getting our local bridges replaced. But if you look from the industry side, there's a lot of contractors that's how they make their living, is replacing local bridges. And when you have a situation where there's funding for 6 months and then none for 18 months, that just is very hard for them to plan their workload. And I think what we're seeing as a result of that is increased unit prices. For one, contractors, we're losing bridge contractors, or they're not investing to expand. So that's really where we need to get to with the bridge program, is just to have enough money so that it can operate throughout the biennium. And the local road improvement program, you know, probably 75% of the projects on this list are non-bridge projects. And I think I would be accurate in saying that with the backlog of projects that are out there, counties could deliver a huge local road improvement program. I think we realize there's a lot of other needs for bonding dollars as well.
Okay. I think I would like to move on. We're going to have to be in session, you know, in about 20 minutes, I think. So, Senator Sendjump, and then...
Just a quick question.
Okay. We'll take a couple quick questions, and then I'd like to get Mr. Jaski up from Bowser to talk about the last item. So, Senator Sendjump.
Mr. Chair, not a question. Just a comment. I don't think, there's a bonding bill has a lot of competing interests, but in my experience at least, with respect to roads, bridges, and wastewater infrastructure, I've never heard a bonding bill criticized for having too much money in those areas. I think that's something, that's a sweet spot, if you will, in a bonding bill. And, as we go forward, whenever we do this year or next, I hope we can give strong consideration to roads, bridges, and wastewater infrastructure.
Thank you.
Chairman, I totally agree with Senator Sendjump on this, but we had MMB in the other day, and they said that our bonding capacity could go up another $300 or $400 million without affecting our rates with Moody's and Standard and Poor's. And I think, Senator, Mr. Chairman, you were at that meeting. But I suppose the problem is, so we could have a higher capacity, see, in the bonding. However, I suppose it's the payment stream that is the issue. Is that correct? I suppose. Does that make sense? I mean, we know the state can be within our limits and go up another $300-400 million, and our rates will not increase with Standard and Poor and Moody's. And the third one. Could you comment on that? We've got the capacity to go higher.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair,
I think Senator Metzen, there's a few other little hurdles that we have to get over, too.
Well, there's always hurdles, but if you don't talk and bring up the issue, you're
Senator
not going to get over those hurdles, so that's where I'm coming from.
So, Mr. Chair, the I understand the capacity is greater than that, but I might be mistaken, just for existing debt capacity for GO bonds.
Mr. Chairman, at the time, the needs are so great. The interest rates are like about less than 3%. We put people back to work. It's just so...
Such a vital program.
Program, and there's not a better time, in my opinion, than now for those reasons. So,
Thank you very much for your information and insight. And we're going to go on to...
Mr. Chairman, I just have a quick question.
Senator Kipmeyer.
Okay, thank you. As a county engineer, and all the other good comments are very nice, but to save time, for your county, what percent of your county budget is spent on roads and bridges? You may not know that. That's why I'm saying it's a quick question, because I think the answer is going to be I don't know off the top of my head. But it would be very interesting to know what percent of county budgets are going to roads and bridges.
Senator Kiffmeyer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Willie.
I guess I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I know in our county, for example, our total budget is around $30 million annually, and about $9 to $10 million of that is for roads and bridges. Now, that includes all funding sources, of course, our state funding sources. our federal funding sources. It includes all funding sources.
I was meaning more, Mr. Chairman, just the county money, not all sources, but just county money.
Senator Kiffmeyer, Mr. Chair, again, in our budget, our total local property tax levy, I believe, and this is round numbers again, but I believe out of about $10 million, about $3 million of that is property tax money that goes towards the maintenance and construction of our road systems.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. We really do need
to
go.
Just wanted to drop one fact on you, Mr.
Senator Dibble.
Ms. Donahoe mentioned 11,000 bridges on the local list, and all the bridges, there are about a little over 20,000 bridges in the state entirely owned by all jurisdictions. So that's over half the bridges that need some attention.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Thank you again. And Mr. Jasky from Bowser, you have approximately 15 minutes, and we're going to have to head upstairs. So, welcome, Mr. Jasky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Jasky, Executive Director, Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and thank you for the opportunity to
talk about this item. Move that microphone right in front of you, please? That way we can hear you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll speak
thank
right
you.
To the microphone. Thanks again for the opportunity to present this item, which is in the governor's recommended bonding bill list. This is a state program, our Reinvest in Minnesota program, which has been around for 26-27 years now, acquires conservation easements for the purpose of achieving water quality benefits, water retention, and habitat as well. We do that with a number of practices, wetland restorations, riparian buffers, and also securing areas around sensitive wellhead locations. This description on the sheet you have in front of you is described as a CREP, or a Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, and this is a very important component of the recently renewed federal farm bill, which passed last year, about a year ago. Minnesota has been working very diligently to see and pursue what the most advantageous options are in that federal funding source to get those dollars here to Minnesota. And this Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program is based on the Conservation Reserve Program, and the E between the C, I'm sorry, between the R and the P is enhancement, which means that a state has the opportunity to combine its funds with the federal dollars to do more. What that means in the case of Minnesota's current circumstance is that if we can come up with around $250 million over the next 5 years, we can leverage approximately $500 million of federal money that would come to the state for conservation purposes, for the green infrastructure that the state relies on for those things that I mentioned earlier, for water quality, for habitat, and for water retention. Where this is at currently is that the state is in discussions with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In order for this to be enacted, the governor will need to sign an agreement with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, with the secretary in Washington. That has not yet been accomplished, but we believe that is a very strong likelihood in the next several months, and we're working towards that goal. We have this program is delivered at the local level using local staff and many contractors to do the land restoration and the construction work. A lot of seed and other types of work is also part of these projects when they take the land that's been used as typically a marginal farmland and convert that into something that is going to be long-lasting conservation sites. One of the most unique aspects of a conservation reserve program is not only the funding, which I talked about. We have that federal money. They appropriate funding on a five-year cycle, so they have in Washington dollars, and they also measure the results in acres. So dollars and acres have been allocated to the Conservation Reserve Program, and so this CREP can be pursued and an agreement achieved without any special federal legislation. That has already been passed last year in the federal farm bill. What we're looking to do is provide the state portion of this through a combination of sources, through bonding, of course, which has been a very traditional source of reinvest in Minnesota or conservation dollars, as well as the legacy dollars to get to that number that I talked about, which is approximately $250 million over the next 5 years. On the back of the sheet, you see some geography, which is the other unique aspect of a Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program proposal. This is still a draft. This is an area of the state based on the science that's been done over the last number of years that shows the places where our water quality challenges are the greatest for nutrients. That's phosphorus and nitrogen are the principal two, and not a lot of that is delivered by, you know, sediment moving off the land and into the water, either surface water or groundwater. And you can see here we're using some of the information that the MPCA has put together that identified the highest priority areas for nutrient reduction. That's the areas in green. We also have the areas in gray, which are watershed areas that are partially identified as having those same problems, but the work hasn't been fully completed yet, but will be during the time of this five-year program. We also identify one groundwater management area there in west central Minnesota, the Bonanza Valley area, where we've got surface and groundwater interacting and the groundwater having some challenges because of the things that get into it before it leaves the surface and goes into the ground. And we also identified some pilot areas for the Department of Agriculture's Ag Water Quality Certification Program that works with farmers to voluntarily identify practices and projects on their land to achieve water quality benefits. So this is the draft geography that we will be starting from. You also see in there the yellow areas are the prairie conservation plan corridors and core areas. This, if we do the projects correctly, we can use native seed and so forth to enhance wildlife habitat at the same time that we're achieving the water quality and the water retention benefits. Again, we have not secured the final agreement with the USDA, but we do need to have some funding in hand in order to show our state commitment to getting those federal dollars. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will stop and take any questions or comments.
Mr. Jaski, I have two questions. One is, and you may have answered it with your last statement, can the state provide the bonding dollars for this? Or obviously it probably will be a combination of sources of money, such as clean water and possibly legacy. I'm not sure. But could the state provide bonding dollars in the 2016 bonding bill versus the 2015 bonding bill, since the contract between the federal and the state hasn't actually been signed?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's true. As long as we have some commitment, we do have some funding that's not been finalized or approved yet through the legacy bill. That's moving forward in Senator Cohen's committee, as you know. What I will say, though, is we need to get to a number which is, you know, $250 million over 5 years. So, you know, the increment just gets bigger, you know, if you have to wait a year. But I think that's what we need to work towards, is coming up with that $250 million over the next 5 years from those sources. And the legacy fund, as you noted, Mr. Chair, has two components. It has a clean water component and an outdoor heritage component, which is the wildlife habitat piece. There is a smaller amount in the legacy bill for that as well. So, again, the total number we got to get to in 5 years is $250 million, and we're going to need all three of those sources to get there.
Okay. Second question is, I believe in the program before, it used to be all permanent easements. And is it possible that, I know in visiting with some farmers and others, the program I think might work better, or at least for some individuals would work better if they did not, you know, if it was 20 years versus permanent? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, we do believe that choices are really important for landowners when they decide what they want to do with their property, including when they decide what types of conservation work they want to do on that property. The way that the current proposal is put together, we are proposing that it be permanent conservation easements that would be added to this federal CRP contract, which is a 10 or 15-year agreement. That CRP program will exist, that will continue on, and so there will be that option for them to people to enroll in the current CRP program. We have other programs as well. The reason for that is twofold. Really, the first is that under the state law, if you're going to go to the level of effort to restore a wetland and make sure that it's going to be there for water quality, habitat, and water retention, that's under current law required to be permanent. The other practices, wellhead protection and riparian buffers, are also something that, you know, we're not likely to see those problems solved and then those areas no longer be needed into the future. And so the goal here would be to invest in this targeted conservation one time and be done with it instead of having to repay again and again. However, I understand your point, and we'll be looking at that topic in some way, shape, or form in our conversation with USDA upcoming.
The reason I mention it, too, is that I believe the previous or the CREP program as it operated before had some difficulty in attracting landowners to participate, and I think the goal is to try to get as many people to participate as possible, because the $750 million program, and generally not addressing large blocks of land, but rather somewhat strategic pieces of land, will amount to a lot of contracts, I would think, out there.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good point. You know, this program is going to give a lot more information than we did, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. We are able to target the landscape using the LIDAR and other data investments that have been made by the legislature. The science that we have allows us to take really just small parts of parcels, the most sensitive areas of landscapes, and put those into conservation. So that's certainly going to be something we're going to look at. And I think that, you know, whether they're permanent or whether they're temporary, you know, this 100,000-acre goal that we're looking at will be we need doing more than that, too. The other conservation programs will continue. This is additive to that. That's a very big landscape, as you know, Mr. Chairman, and we want to make sure we put the acres where they can do the most. And, you know, even though the CRP program has been around for, well, since 1985, actually, under federal authorization, those acres come and go, as you know, and right now we're under a diminution. Those acres are coming out of conservation because of the federal cap and also because of some cases in northwestern Minnesota, the county caps that were met, and the dollars aren't there like they used to be. So we will be talking with USDA about all the possibilities.
Any other questions that members have? Senator Senjum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today. I have a question. I'm just trying to understand a little bit. You know, the governor's buffer land proposal, I think, calls for 125,000 acres. We're talking on this sheet at least about 100,000 acres. One seems to be one of, you know, the buffer land proposal has, you know, it's controversial. I don't think there's any question about it. CREP, on the other hand, is generally kind of not controversial. Cannot CREP kind of move us towards the direction the governor wants to? I don't want to put you too much on a spot, but in a much smoother glide path, so to speak.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum, certainly this could support or supplement the governor's ideas about trying to get more buffers in place faster. Let me just highlight a couple of examples. Actually, one of them is in your backyard. There are six counties that have undertaken a systematic approach to getting the buffers in across the state. Olmsted County is one of them, Dodge County right next door, and you know, Dakota County, Blue Earth County, Ottertail County, and Grant County, the other ones that have done this. And in Olmsted County, they were able to achieve compliance. Of course, the county board had to take that on through their regulatory authorities, but they did that really only after they were threatened to be sued by some landowners that wanted to see the buffers get in place. And so I think one of our challenges is that across the state we don't have local governments doing it equitably. If some are doing it, some aren't. We've got landowners that put buffers in and some don't. So I think the governor's proposal is really to get to a level playing field across the state. And this will certainly help, because the way that landowners achieve compliance in those six counties is largely either by their own initiative or enrolling in the conservation programs that were offered to them. They were given that choice once or twice or even three times, and many of them did that, and they ended up with, in Olmsted County, I think they told me it was 472 people who were communicated with about the need to put a buffer in. They only ended up with two out of 470 that somebody had to do something further with to make sure they did what they didn't otherwise want to do. So it's a package deal, Senator.
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to add to that, I represent Olmsted County and have spent a good deal of time visiting with the property owners and the county. And my, it's not exactly too crap, but we are talking about the governor's buffer proposal. And my takeaway from all those conversations is that it works well in Olmsted County because it's a carrot approach instead of a stick approach. And it's very locally driven, working very closely with the SWCD staff, and that it has been embraced, as opposed to the governor's buffer proposal, which has caused a great deal of angst. So I appreciate Senator Senjum's comments about CREP being an alternative way to get to maybe the same point.
Is Mr. Harnack, I see, wanting to get a word in here quickly before the sergeant comes down and carries us up to the Senate.
Let me just respond to Senator Nelson's comment. I think that your points are very well taken. I know you've talked with those people, and they know what they're doing. And I would agree that the CREP could be a supplement to what the governor's proposal is at this point.
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ron Harnack with the Red River Watershed Management Board. And a couple comments regarding, first of all, the flood damage reduction program. I think, as Kent pointed out, we've made a lot of progress over the last number of years. But there are several projects where communities have almost completed their flood control projects. And it would be unfortunate if we could not get them the funding this year to complete those. They're ready to go. We were fortunate enough not to have a major flood in the Red River Valley this year, but you can look across the state from last year and see what happens when you have a major event that you're not necessarily anticipating and, you know, the devastation that that can cause. So getting these communities protected, I think, is really critical and taken care of. We should also acknowledge, as Senator Metzen said, that we need to give priority to also acquiring and relocating homes out of the floodplain. That is ultimately the best mitigation we can have anywhere, is not having folks at risk whatsoever. Two other things. The counties mentioned the need for wetland road replacement funding. I think we need to give greater consideration to coordinating that with some of the flood mitigation, water impoundments, water retention, water storage projects that we do, because we do get multi-purpose benefits as an outgrowth of that. We do restore a lot of wetlands in relationship with those impoundments, and I think we need to do a better job of coordinating those efforts to get a bigger bang for our buck. Lastly, I do have a strong support for CREP. I am concerned, though, with when you look at your map where the cutoff comes, it seems to be that State Highway 10 seems to be the cutoff. It seems to leave me the impression that it's more pheasants than anything else, because that's the pheasant line typically. And certainly there are significant water quality problems when you look to the northern part of the Red River Valley. Lake Winnipeg.
Okay.
Is our dumping ground, no different than what the Mississippi River is in terms of the Gulf of Mexico. So I would hope that that line, that imaginary line, you know, would stop at the Canadian border rather than just stopping somewhere along Highway 10. And lastly, to make any of this CREP buffers or whatever those kinds of things work, you got to fund the SWCDs. They are the ones that work one-on-one with the landowners out there on the ground and make this work. So whatever you can do to ensure that there is a significant portion of funding for SWCDs, you don't need a mandate if you can put people on the ground to work with producers. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Harnack. I've just been informed that the two caucuses are caucusing the tax bill. So you don't need to go up to the floor. You can just go to the caucus room. So thank you, all of you who have testified, and thank you for the committee members for being here. Committee is adjourned. We'll notify you in the next meeting.